Some crimes are never forgotten. Others are lost to history. Those are the ones we focus on in Crimes of the Centuries, a history meets true crime podcast revisiting murders, trials, and frauds that once dominated headlines. I'm Amber Hunt, your host and a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. If you like true crime that feels both cinematic and historical, find Crimes of the Centuries wherever you get your podcasts. Some crimes are never forgotten, others are lost to history. Those are the ones we focus on in Crimes of the Centuries, a history meets true crime podcast revisiting murders, trials, and frauds that once dominated headlines. I'm Amber Hunt, your host and a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. If you like true crime that feels both cinematic and historical, find Crimes of the Centuries wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
TMZ has reported that the Reiner family has grown used to Nick's alarming behavior. At Conan O'Brien's holiday party the night before the murders, guests were reportedly considering calling 911 after Nick's erratic behavior and a loud argument with his father. But the Reiners, they just apologized and left. They'd been managing crisis after crisis for 30 years. They paid for 18-plus rehab stays, dual diagnosis facilities, the best treatment that money could buy. And still in this second part here, I want to understand the family psychology, how people who love someone can become trapped in a system that ultimately destroys them. Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author, is with us. Grown used to it. That's the phrase that TMZ is reporting that was used. I mean, it's haunting. It's understandable for anybody who's been around someone's erratic behavior for long periods of time and can't really find a way out without extreme measures, like just completely separating yourself from the person, whether it be a parent, a family member, a loved one, a spouse. If you don't want to go to that extreme and you're going to try and manage it, you just kind of get used to it. It gets normalized over time. And strangers don't necessarily see it because they're seeing the erraticness. You're not, because you're used to it so much. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that. I mean, is when you get to that point, you know, some may look at it as enabling, survival, exhaustion, or something else entirely. What's going on? What was going on? Obviously, for the Reiners here, the family, and anyone else who finds themselves in those sort of situations when they don't realize just how hot the pot has gotten as the water boils and everybody else is like, why are you in there?
Yeah, that's the exact analogy that came to me. It builds over time. They see it every day. It just becomes what they're used to coping with. They do their best and they hold on to hope. And as we've said, the hope can be quite a trap. You know, look at that image of him. In every image of him I've seen, that is the look of a psychotic person. They, when they're symptomatic, they get this complete flat expression. They've got a weird look in their eyes. And my guess is the Reiners, in posing for family pictures with him, they didn't even notice that, you know, where most of us would go, who's the weird person in this picture?
Yes.
You know, and it stands out as him. And they're all smiling, and some of the pictures with their other kids, everybody looks normal, and you can spot the sick person here. So there's a bit of denial going on. They don't want to lose hope because families cling to that, but it's very hard. And we talked before about, you know, what do you do when you're sensing danger, when they're putting holes in the walls in the house, when they're threatening? It's hard. And of course, the best thing people can do in that situation is call 911 and hope they at least get a 72-hour hold. But how do they protect themselves in a moment? I have another little true story that occurred to me I haven't shared with you yet. My husband had a good friend. This was my late husband, years ago, who was a very nice guy in the community. He ran a lawnmower shop and everybody loved him, the friendly neighborhood guy. And he lived about a mile from us. And it turns out the public did not know he was bipolar and got very psychotic one day, was threatening his wife and his brother in his home. And what did they do? They pushed him out the door and locked him out. Okay. They were trying to stay safe. There's a boundary, right? We want people to set boundaries. What did he do? He ran to our house. I happened to be sitting naked in the bathtub at the time. It was early on a Sunday morning. My husband was in the other room watching football or something in the bedroom. I hear someone burst open in our front door because my husband had let the dogs out and he hadn't locked the door again. Bad thing, keep your door locked. And this guy burst in. I heard screaming and ranting in the living room, which was right around the corner from me sitting naked in the bathtub. Talk about scared to death.
Yeah.
And so I ran out. My husband tried to restrain him, push him out the front door. And I was on the phone with 911. I didn't recognize who he was because he was so out of control. But
you knew this man.
I knew him, but I didn't recognize him. I thought he was a stranger because he was so disheveled and so bizarre. And why did he come to our house? I guess he just knew where we lived and figured, hey, I can't get in my house. I'll just go over there. But the cops came immediately, picked him up, took him in for a hold. And I was so upset. I said, I don't ever want contact with that family again. And I was angry at the family for handling it that way. Why didn't they call 911? It's like you don't just push them out the door and let him go wreak havoc in the neighborhood. So it's really hard for families to know what to do. And Stacy, as you've mentioned, sometimes there have been shootings. 50% of the police shootings are in these situations when the person is told to comply or get down on the ground or drop the knife. They're psychotic. They don't comply. And then they end up dead. So it's really, families are in a bind. And yes, they love this kid. But as we've said, with the $10,000 a month allowance, that's enabling. That's not helping. And we really need a system that functions where families are not put in this position of having to manage a mentally ill person.
Families aren't prepared or equipped to handle a mentally ill person. I mean, even someone with training, I mean, and experience like yourself, I mean, nobody is equipped to do this in their own home ever, period. It's just no one should be doing that. There are places when someone is in that sort of state. And you're exactly right. The biggest thing is families hold on to hope.
Yeah.
They hold on to that hope that something's going to change. They're going to get better. They remember a time. And it's horrible sometimes, especially when people like this go up and down and up and down. And you got a couple good months here and see, look, they're demonstrating everything can be fine and dandy and it's wonderful. And then all of a sudden, shit can just go sideways very, very fast. And I mean, correct me if I'm wrong here, but you know, when you try to analyze, well, why didn't the family call 911 in this situation? Why hadn't this some sort of intervention outside of the family taken place beforehand in various situations? And I'm talking beyond Nick Reiner here. It's because it makes it real. Because it makes it real beyond the confines of that home. When other people get involved and other people are aware of this, then it's real. Then it's a real problem. Then it's something that has to be dealt with beyond just our hopes and wishes and dreams and whatever other bullshit we like to tell ourselves that things are just going to get better. And the person who is perpetrating a lot of these issues, that's the kryptonite. They also know. They don't want to be called out or called on or have somebody outside come in and make it real. And holding on to hope for a lot of people, that becomes something they do for many, 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 many years rather than simply accept reality. And it's not easy to accept reality when it comes to something like this. I remember an example of that in my own world, in my own life. I was with someone for a very long time and they had basically a psychotic break going on, but there was years of patterns of behavior that led up to this. And when I finally had to call 911, the first thing that was said was no, because then you know, then they're going to take me away. Then they're going to see what I'm, what I basically, what I am, you know, of what, and like, and my reaction was, you're damn right they are, because I can't do this anymore by myself.
Yeah.
And then reality hits you hard. And then those ideas, those years of well, this was good for this time and that time, it all goes out the window and you're suddenly in a very new reality. And you know, if you're chugging along okay, you know, blowing up the world isn't exactly something that's on everybody's to-do list at that moment in time. Maybe it will get better. Maybe it will temporarily.
Maybe.
But it's always it always is going to go back to something horrible. Is that why you think a lot of times these sort of things fester for as long as they do? Not only on the part of the person who's you know, ill, that is victimizing others, but also on the part of the people who are healthy, who also, you know, are dealing with their own stuff and trying to keep a semblance of normalcy in their lives without dropping a bomb on an already explosive situation.
Yeah, it's the work in therapy, I think, for families. And as we've said, I always encourage families to go to therapy to get support. Doesn't mean that they're mentally ill, but it's support for how do I cope with my mentally ill relative here, because they need some outside objectivity to deal with that hope and that unrealistic expectation that things can improve. And I think that's where a good therapist who's experienced with psychosis, not all are, but to give them a gentle nudge toward reality that your hope is unrealistic here. I see people clinging to that, and it cycles. Their loved one, usually their adult child, is incarcerated, goes into a mental facility, gets out, and they take them back into their home again. And then they'll say, oh, but he's applying for jobs now. And I can look at this and say, this has been going on for 20 years. He's not going to be employed. You know, so he's on his medications now. He has a history of going off them, and then he gets dangerous, and then the cycle starts over again. But it's very hard for parents to hear that.
Well, and they're wrapped up in the cycle too. They're part of the cycle as well. So it's just this repetitive nature of, oh, he got better. Here we go again.
Yeah.
And again, it's something I see in our chat section. A lot of people are wondering why the parents just kept putting up with it, and they should have thrown him away and you know, thrown the key away as well. The love of a child is such that they just hold on to that hope, and it's the hope that kills you.
Yeah.
And in this case, it actually did.
Yeah, it did. Sad. And there are parents who throw them out to break the bonds. But as you've also said, Stacey, then that puts the dangerous person out into the homeless population on the street. And and we know how much violence goes on in those communities. And, you know, there are terrible cases of people walking down the street. It's happened in my city. And a psychotic person just comes up and stabs them to death. You know, I mean, there was one recently like that. And so I think there's also an element of, well, we don't want to put this person out because they're going to deteriorate even more and become more dangerous. So parents are really between a rock and a hard place on how the hell do you work with this.
I think you got that with parents, you have that with spouses, you have that with anybody that's caring for someone like this. And that's the really the harsh reality of it is, if you are the healthy one in the relationship, you oftentimes view yourself as, I'm the only person like keeping this all together. And it's not even always the fear that something's going to happen to them by someone else. It's what are they going to do?
What are they capable
of doing? And what could possibly happen in those sort of scenarios? And what are they capable of doing, you know, if my influence is gone? If I said, you know, screw this, you're on your own. They still have autonomy, because there's not a way to just go, they're crazy, lock them up forever. That's not how this works. They're going to be out there. They're going to be able to do their crazy stuff. And they're going to act out in the ways that they do. And if you just decide to cut that leash, you have no idea when that rabid animal is going to come flying back through your window one night at 3 a.m. because of whatever the hell delusion is going on in their mind. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of times, if you're the parent, if you're the spouse, if you're the whatever, you're constantly thinking, well, it's bad, but it ain't that bad.
Not yet.
But it's a lose-lose proposition for somebody in that caregiver type situation. But you do wonder about that. And I think that's what also keeps people close. I think I see this too a lot, not just in like the parent-child or parent-adult-child, but in the spouse-type situation where I would guess, and I think this is very underreported and underestimated because it's hard to quantify it. Because there's not just like stats out there on this, where you have one parent staying with the other parent because they don't trust the other parent with the well-being of the child on their own. Mm-hmm. And if you're there, if you're able to sit there and kind of be the check to make sure that nothing crazy happens here, okay, then their interactions are fine. But the idea of this person that you know that is not mentally stable taking care of this child on their own who doesn't have very much autonomy, that's far scarier than going, I'll eat pigeon here for a little while and just deal with this because I'm going to keep my kids safe versus that. I think that's a very real reality. That's something I dealt with. That's how I felt for a very long time. And that's part of the reasons I kept and stayed in a very toxic relationship for a while, because you're thinking about all the possibilities down the road, the cause and effect. Not everyone does that, but I think that's a reason a lot of people stay in those sort of relationships.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other component of this that has struck me is at 78 years old, my gosh, what were the plans for him after they're gone?
Yeah.
You know, what was going to happen?
Well, and what would have happened when they start their decline? They probably were on their decline. Right. I mean, I heard a lot of interviews with Rob Reiner in recent years, and he seemed very on top of things. But within a matter of years, his mental capacity could have started to decline. So now you've got, let's just say, and I don't know this, but I'm just speculating, you know, maybe he's 83, 84 years old and starting to develop dementia.
Exactly.
And now his wife, who's younger, is caring for him and this other child. Now you've just got this tornado of what the F. I can't imagine.
And I think you have in the Reiner situation, and I'm just, you know, speaking from observation, I'm going to guess. I mean, they were a fairly tight-knit family. Rob and Michelle probably had it in their mind that, well, you know, once we pass on, they got Romy and they got the other kid there that will take care, that they'll take care of their loved one because they're family and that's what families do. I think we see the reality of that today where, you know, a bond between a mother or and a father and a child is very different than that necessarily of a sibling relationship. And the mother-father bond tends to have a lot more grace, if you will. These other folks, they have their own lives to live. Yeah. They're not there to be the caregiver of the sibling that can't get their shit together for whatever reason it may be. And I think that's also where we see the reaction. And again, we don't know exactly what happened, why Alan Jackson left this case, as to why Nika now has a public defender, because I think they said very quickly, no. Right. I mean, mom and dad played that role, all that, and we maybe didn't necessarily agree with it, but we're not saying it out loud. We are not mom and dad. Mm-hmm. And good effing luck.
And that's a healthy response. Yes, I would always encourage siblings to not take on that role. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not theirs to play. It's not, no matter what anybody tries to tell you or guilt you or your mind guilting yourself, it's not your role.
Yeah.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Some crimes are never forgotten. Others are lost to history. Those are the ones we focus on in Crimes of the Centuries, a history meets true crime podcast revisiting murders, trials, and frauds that once dominated headlines. I'm Amber Hunt, your host and a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. If you like true crime that feels both cinematic and historical, find Crimes of the Centuries wherever you get your podcasts. Some crimes are never forgotten. Others are lost to history. Those are the ones we focus on in Crimes of the Centuries, a history meets true crime podcast revisiting murders, trials, and frauds that once dominated headlines. I'm Amber Hunt, your host and a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. If you like true crime that feels both cinematic and historical, find Crimes of the Centuries wherever you get your podcasts. Some crimes are never forgotten. Others are lost to history. Those are the ones we focus on in Crimes of the Centuries, a history meets true crime podcast revisiting murders, trials, and frauds that once dominated headlines. I'm Amber Hunt, your host and a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. If you like true crime that feels both cinematic and historical, find Crimes of the Centuries wherever you get your podcasts. Some crimes are never forgotten. Others are lost to history. Those are the ones we focus on in Crimes of the Centuries, a history meets true crime podcast revisiting murders, trials, and frauds that once dominated headlines. I'm Amber Hunt, your host and a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. If you like true crime that feels both cinematic and historical, find Crimes of the Centuries wherever you get your podcasts. Some crimes are never forgotten. Others are lost to history. Those are the ones we focus on in Crimes of the Centuries, a history meets true crime podcast revisiting murders, trials, and frauds that once dominated headlines. I'm Amber Hunt, your host and a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. If you like true crime that feels both cinematic and historical, find Crimes of the Centuries wherever you get your podcasts. Some crimes are never forgotten. Others are lost to history. Those are the ones we focus on in Crimes of the Centuries, a history meets true crime podcast revisiting murders, trials, and frauds that once dominated headlines. I'm Amber Hunt, your host and a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. If you like true crime that feels both cinematic and historical, find Crimes of the Centuries wherever you get your podcasts. Some crimes are never forgotten. Others are lost to history. Those are the ones we focus on in Crimes of the Centuries, a history meets true crime podcast revisiting murders, trials, and frauds that once dominated headlines. I'm Amber Hunt, your host and a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. If you like true crime that feels both cinematic and historical, find Crimes of the Centuries wherever you get your podcasts.